Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network's Ewoks.
Ewoks, the Ewoks, rapidly Ewoks, living in the tall trees, living in the sky.
As we anxiously await the final Clone Wars series bonus episodes, we will be looking back this summer as we watch and review all episodes of this classic Star Wars TV series.
Hello and welcome back to Republic Forces Radio Network as we continue to slog through summer school watching the Ewoks animated series, seasons 1 and 2. Tonight, we're discussing three different stories, the Season Scepter, Browbeaten, and Baga's Rival. And joining me as they have this entire summer semester is Barrett.
Hey everybody, good to be back this week with you, Jonathan, and Jerry, and Nathan to talk some more Ewoks. Oh, my quark.
Kvark. Jerry.
Man, going to summer school all the time just makes me feel like a lurdo.
And the teacher's pet, Nathan.
Jerry, I don't know why you got a problem with summer school, man. I'm excited enough I could flip on my ice-shaped head and go sliding across the ground.
So the first story we're going to discuss tonight is The Season Scepter, originally released November 1st, 1986. And as you probably have not seen it, I'm going to start us with a bit of a summary. While hanging around and watching Tebow practice his magic, the young Ewoks are caught in a freak snowstorm. It appears that the Snow King, in a bid to impress Odra, the Duchess of Sleet, has stolen the Season Scepter from the Sun King. The Ewoks are contacted by the Leaf Queen, who asks Logray for help. Since Logray is not present to hear the message, the young Ewoks race to follow her instructions, making their way to the Sun King's palace on a giant flying leaf. As they make their way, the Snow King and Odra notice them, intending to capture them to get the Sun Star Shadow Stone. We learn that Odra is only using the Snow King to gain power rather than actually wanting to be his queen. Set upon by the Snow King's ice heads, the young Ewoks find their journey derailed and Nissa is captured. Tebow, Wicket, and Latara enter the Sun King's home where they find the Leaf Queen, Flower Queen, and Sun King, three of the siblings who, along with the Snow King, control the seasons on Endor through the use of the Season Scepter. They explain about his theft of the Season Scepter and how his heart has been frozen by Odra. The Iceheads had stolen the Season Scepter from the Sun King while he was relaxing on the beach, and that began the snowfall. Unfortunately, of the possible solutions available, only the Sunstar Shadowstone can melt the Snow King's heart, and the young Ewoks don't have it with them. The only other thing that will work is the Season Scepter itself, but the Snow King has control of it. Back at Bright Tree Village, Chirpa saves Logray from being buried in snow. They contact the Leaf Queen even as the three young Ewoks head out on their own to the Snow Palace to save Nissa. Disguising themselves as Snowheads, the Ewoks sneak into the palace, where they see Nissa blasted by the Snow King and frozen in a block of ice. They now intend to trade Nissa to Chirpa for the Sunstar Shadowstone. They confront the Snow King and Odra, stealing back the Season Scepter, which Tebow cannot control. Together, though, the combined willpower of Tebow and Wicket manages to melt the Snow King's heart and melt Odra down to her original minuscule size. The Snow King releases Nissa and returns the moon to Summer. The Season Scepter is then returned to the Sun King, who arrives just after the day is saved. Wicket is then given a hockey stick-like club from the Iceheads to put on his belt of honor.
Wow.
I don't even know how to talk about this episode.
This is the one thing that just baffles me about Ewok life. I mean, how many amazing devices of awesome power is on this planet?
I mean, seriously, the seasons on Endor really changed by a bunch of siblings trading around a stick.
Well, maybe they're just, you know, they're part of it. They're these, you know, we've got this backstory now where they've told us in later materials, they're essentially like very strong force-powered beings that wind up as some of the many castaways of Endor, as the article that mentioned them is referred to. And yeah, maybe they have some influence, or they simply would like to think that they have influence. And when the time comes, they use it, but maybe it's more of a formality type of a thing. I mean, we don't see them actually doing the changes when a season is needing to be changed. All we see is that they've got this technology or magic or whatever, force power, to change the seasons at will. So it could be just, you know, kind of mythology built up around them, very much like if you want to take a Stargate example, like the Goa'uld or the Ori using their phenomenal power and technology that's beyond what the natives have to sort of make themselves into these beings that maybe they're really not. It's no more ridiculous than half the stuff we wind up seeing throughout this series. I mean, just it's at least this we can say it's force beings that have some extra abilities or something. At least there's a way to somewhat rationalize it if magic is the force.
Okay, Nathan. If these are force beings, and we're going to use the whole idea that midichlorians control or allow people to touch the force, there are a bunch of very drunk midichlorians on Endor, because I don't know what the heck is going on. This is so beyond anything. I'm going to go out and say it. I think this might be the worst episode of the entire series.
Oh!
This was just so off the rails. I mean, you've got a Sun King who is, like, sitting on a beach in practically a Hawaiian shirt, just going, "Hey man, have a drink." What the heck is going on here?
Don't forget the fact that the snowheads out there, you know, when they do their marching, we get that classic Wizard of Oz kind of snowy, oh, snow. Although that was great, and there's a lot of little nuances where they kind of take this and they connect it to Wizard of Oz again, which is something that Clone Wars did. It seems like it's kind of an experimental type of storytelling, for lack of a better term, perhaps experimenting with drugs while they're doing the storytelling, but experimental storytelling.
I would have killed to be a fly on the wall during story talks where they came up with this episode, because there was something passed around that room.
I imagine it's similar to Keith Richards and Mick Jagger writing a song.
Yes, they're called the Ice Heads. And yes, there are probably a lot of people drunk on Endor. Like, why? I have to question Logray's decision to keep letting Tebow practice magic. I mean, Tebow thought he was responsible for planet-wide climate change. But you know, how else is Endor supposed to change their climate? As far as I understand, Endor orbited the Death Star, right? They don't orbit a sun or a star.
There's a star, and the planet orbits the star, and this moon of Endor orbits the planet. So, I mean, I don't know as astronomy really at all, but I mean, do moons get to have seasons anyway? Or does it just depend on whether they rotate?
I think it depends on how large they are, how close their orbit is to their planet, how close that planet's orbit is to the, you know, the central star of that system. And I mean, there are a lot of factors, but this isn't the first time we've seen a moon in the Star Wars universe be habitable. Think back to episode 4. It was the fourth moon of the planet Yavin. It wasn't Yavin itself. That being said, I'm sorry, even if I was, you know, 6-7 years old, I would have been like, this isn't how seasons change. This is crap, guys. I'm sorry. I'm going to just call it out. This is crap.
No way. I don't like, you're going to call, look at Uldra. Did you take a look at Uldra? You're going to call her crap? She's the best looking villain we got in season 2 right now. I would have given her the season scepter myself.
No, I think that, I mean, this is, yes, it's extreme. Yeah, and I'll give you that. I mean, the Sun King being a beach bum is kind of stupid. Having a Leaf Queen in the first place was kind of stupid. And now we have the Flower Queen, and now we have the Snow King. And apparently Odra was like an ice sprite that somehow got larger. I mean, there's a lot of, oh, you've got to be kidding me to this. But seen within the context of what they try to make these out to be, within the context of the rest of the show, it's like these are, if Endor is the gas giant, and this is the forest moon, and we'll just say that this is only for the forest moon, this doesn't affect anything else in the Endor system, then it's kind of like they are this world's low-rent version of the ones. Right? I mean, the sun, the daughter, the father, there's balance. It can shift one direction or the other, that the planet, in that case, Mortis, is able to adapt and shift based on the force balance between them, very much like Tython with the force storms and such that we get with the Old Republic and Dawn of the Jedi. These are kind of the low-rent, crappy B-movie versions of those type of concepts. I mean, don't get me wrong, the episode is crap. The episode is terrible. When you actually watch it, minus seeing the ice head zip around and kind of wish that you could do that if you had Arsenio Hall hair. But the concept, I think, has more merit to it now than it did back then, seen within the context of the way that modern EU sources have tried to explain this and the way we have the ones and such tied into it. It's not as ridiculous in 2013 as it is in 1986. And a lot of this series was ridiculous in 86, and most of it's just become more ridiculous. It's nice that at least something has a little bit more in the modern EU to try to give it some measure of validity than less, for once.
You know, Nathan, I really respect that you're trying to justify some of the decisions made in this kind of like maybe even sort of retcon some things into this. I'm not buying it. This doesn't even fit with the other bad episodes that we've seen from this season. I mean, I could deal with the Leaf Queen. Well, I can't, but you know, that we saw earlier this year in giving the wish plant. I could kind of cope with that. But, you know, to see that we now have like these four kind of balancing the seasons and controlling Endor. I mean, yeah, Empire, build that Death Star and blow this place up. It needs to go.
Well, hey, if they're not immortal, then unless there's incest involved, you don't have to worry within a few generations. They'll all die off because they're all four siblings anyway. And then no harm, no foul.
And they're just force users or whatever. And it doesn't mean that Endor's climate could not change by itself. It's just that they influence it. But come on, we get an Endor Wampa, Jonathan. An Endor Wampa.
I did kind of like the Wampa character. But, oh man, remember, I watched this twice, and the second time, it was just sort of like, oh God, do I have to do this? Please, no. This just, I mean, the flying leaf that splits down the middle and then reseals it. I mean, really?
That was funny. You know, another
okay,
funny
the
part.
Okay, the flying leaf was awful. That was just dumb.
That was awful. But another funny part was that Wicket, Nissa, Tebow, Latara, they really should have looked for Law Gray because he was buried in snow. I loved that.
What was he doing? He was just sitting there.
He was just sitting there, buried in snow. Why did he go out there? It's like, what was he doing? Where was he? And he was just buried in snow. They definitely should have looked for him.
I can tell you exactly what he was doing. Chilling.
Nice. I was waiting for like...
That was easy.
Waiting for Law Gray somewhere along the way just to say, I'm an old man. I'm confused.
Indoor dementia.
And how annoying is Wicket's laugh? You know, I never paid attention to his laugh, but it's really like a like he's poking you in the chest when he's laughing at you. Come on, Jonathan, that saves this episode, right?
No, it doesn't. Not for me. I mean, I just can't get over this, guys. I'm probably being way too petty, but this episode really bothered me just in the how really stupid it was.
Well, if this episode really bothered you, how about the next episode? Browbeaten? Will we get the return of the Duloc?
And I have to say, I kind of liked Browbeaten. That one was originally released on November 8th, 1986. And in this episode, while the fishing festival nears, Logray brings a special magical prow carving for Chief Chirpa's canoe. Wicket and Tebow, eager to help, are given the task of cleaning the canoe before the festival. Meanwhile, the Duloc King Gorniche prepares to strike the fishing festival with a new Duloc battleship, piloted by Gorniche, Urga, and Umwok. Back at the river near the village, Wicket and Tebow give Nissa and Latara a ride in Chirpa's canoe without permission. They, of course, crash into a rock. They manage to save the canoe, but the magical carving has fallen off into the river, only to be found by the Duloks and placed on the prow of their battleship. The four Ewoks try to get the carving, but they are caught and made help to row. The battleship is accosted by the Skibs, whose home the Duloks had destroyed to test their warship. With the help of the Skibs, the young Ewoks drive off the Duloks and use the battleship's own catapult and several wild club swings by Gorniche to sink it, but the carving goes down with the ship. The Skibs help the Ewoks return home, where they report the loss of the carving and their victory against the Duloks. Chirpa is proud of their victory and their honesty and asks them to put his new prow carving onto the canoe. Apparently losing it wasn't that bad after all. Now I have to say, I found this episode very amusing, and it's probably because, like you, Baron, I enjoy the Duloks. What did you guys think?
This episode made me realize how little of a presence the Duloks have in season two, because I watched this and I was like, oh, right, the Duloks. Forgot about them. They're like the weekly bad guys of season one.
I gotta say, this one rubbed me the wrong way to an extent. I mean, to begin with, it was just kind of the standard, okay, you let the youngs do something while the adults are away. They break something. They lose something. Oh no, how are they ever going to fix it? And yet in the end, the adults still find out and everything's okay type of story, just transplanted to the forest moon of Endor. What got me about this episode is the same thing that gets me about the Millennium Falcon novel by James Luceno. And this has come out quite a few years ago here, so I'm not going to spoil anything specific, but basically the whole point of that novel is the search for this one item. And they pull a Maltese Falcon. And it turns out in the end that the item they were looking for the entire time, it's basically just a red herring. What they were trying to get wasn't really what it was supposed to be. And that's what gets me about this episode. I'm with it all the way up to the last minute or so, where we have, you know, them finally try to get back this prow carving. They need to make sure it's there because presumably it's magic or something, and it's needed for the ceremony, and they want to make sure that Chirpa is okay. You know, that he's got this magical thing that he needs for this big auspicious moment. And instead, at the end, it's, oh, check it out, we got a new one. We don't even need that old one that you lost. Oh, well. And the entire point of them hunting for it kind of goes down the tubes. Granted, you could say, well, yeah, but they had to find it because it was their responsibility and they lost it. So in that sense, it still was meaningful whether or not they got it in the end. But really, it had no value. It was being replaced as it was. It just kind of causes the entire rest of the episode, the other 10 minutes of this story, to just kind of flop for me.
But I love the Duloc battleship.
I was so proud of the Dulocs. Other times when they need stuff, they steal it, or they have to eat. They try to trick people into doing things for them. They built this themselves, right? This is like your little brother who built something himself. So it's his first baking soda volcano. You know, it worked too. It didn't sink. It was pretty good.
It's our Pinewood Derby, huh?
But they built it to steal the Ewok's fish from the fishing festival.
I love it how the diabolical plot starts off as, hey, the Ewoks are having a picnic. Let's ruin it. That'll teach them.
The one thing I really like about the Duloks is in season two, and to your point, Jerry, I wish they did have a bigger presence. I mean, they could be so much. I mean, their character design is so good. It looks so well that they didn't even touch it. That, to your point too, Nathan, a couple shows ago where they didn't change the voice actors for Gordish and Urga. I love them. It's almost like a wasted opportunity to use them whenever they can. And the one other thing I liked about it is they're more consistent. They're as consistent from season one to season two as far as their attitude, where they're kind of evil, but they really don't want to wipe the Ewoks out. They're related to the Ewoks. They just want to cause some problems, you know. They're just kind of like bullies. They don't really want to hurt the Ewoks, and we see villains in this series who really want to hurt the Ewoks, and so they're likable, they're redeemable. You can almost see that if the Ewoks and the Duloks had a common enemy, hint, hint, the Empire, that they could get together and work together to get those people out of Endor. I really like the Duloks.
Barrett, speaking of missed opportunities, it's silly, but when the Duloks' ship is sunk, I really wanted Gornish to go, you sunk my battleship.
Oh, and that's bad. That's bad. Who produced Battleship? Was that Mattel?
Hasbro.
Hasbro? So they couldn't have, right? Because this was Kenner that was doing all the Star Wars stuff. They would have had a little bit of a conflict there. You know, I will say it's nice to see the Duloks back again because they were such a big presence in season one. But you know what? Except for one brief mention, they're done. This is the last Dulok episode of Ewoks. And this is how we send them out. An okay tale, minus the ending, but they don't get any big grand battle, any big grand send-off. It's just later, for the rest of this season, except for a brief mention in Party Ewok, it's like they might as well not even exist.
It's okay, because there could be more Duloc stories out there, Nathan. And I want, you know, you could write it eventually. You could bring the Duloks back one day.
Yeah, your return to comics, Nathan. You know, the return of the Duloks.
Hey, they had me bring back Kyle Katarn. Why not the Duloks? Why not both? Find out that the new warrior who's supposed to bring balance to the Force that was chosen by Mortis is Gornish.
Moving on to the last story of this episode of Republic Forces, Baga's Rival, released November 8th, 1986. While trying to give Baga a bath, Wicket, Nissa, Tebow, and Latara come upon a Quarf who they name Silky. They take Silky back to Brighttree Village, spending time with her rather than Baga. Silky, though, ends up being the magical pet of Jadru the Enchantress, who intends to use Silky to steal the Sunstar Shadowstone. When Nissa takes a ride on Silky, the creature takes her back to Jadru's lair and reveals Silky's true reptilian form. Jadru intends to trade Nissa to Chief Chirpa for the Sunstar Shadowstone, but Wicket, Tebow, and Latara follow thanks to the keen olfactory senses of Baga. While Latara and Tebow return to tell Chirpa what has happened, Wicket and Baga enter Jadru's lair, which is essentially a large maze. After finding their way through the maze, again, thanks largely to Baga, they managed to get Jadru to come after them and then trap Jadru and Silky in their own maze and rescue Nisa. Baga has saved his master even after being treated so unfairly. Led by Thibaut and Latara, the adult Ewoks arrive and break the levers that control the maze, trapping Jadru and Silky for good. In return for his bravery, one of the levers is given to Wicket for his Belt of Honor.
So what do you think? Once they're trapped in the maze, which one eats the other one first?
You know, I have to admit I did think that watching this. I'm like, oh, well.
Catwoman and her reptile. This was, again, kind of a weird episode. You know, you've got that whole moralistic aspect of it, of the, you know, giving up the old friend or the old pet for the flashy new one, and that, you know, what's flashy and new is not always necessarily better, and it leads them into a trap. You get the weird sort of magic shape-shifting or illusion thing going on, very much like what we saw with Morag being able to do when she lured in the Ewoks, very much like what will see Sharl, the Night Sister, able to do with her ring and such later on. So, you know, kind of consistent in that sense. It wasn't a bad episode. I mean, it was a little odd, but so are most of the ones in season two. What kind of strikes me about this, and you guys have mentioned this previously, that it seems like over and over again we now have people coming after the Sunstar Shadowstone. And granted, in the series, in season two, they almost always just call it the Sunstar, not the Sunstar Shadowstone. What kind of makes me wonder is maybe if in Sunstar versus Shadowstone, when it got put back together, when Morag was defeated, if perhaps that's what's causing all these people to come out of the woodwork wanting to get their hands on it. The fact that it is back together and has its full magical power, or if by the fact that they're just calling it the Sunstar, not the Sunstar Shadowstone, if these people are completely oblivious to the fact that it's been put back together and is more powerful, and they're just looking for the half that Logre had for so long. But it'd be an interesting thing to see what effect that episode had in the minds of the writers when it comes to setting up this season. Was it just, hey, that's an easy MacGuffin to send them all after? Or was it planned that now that it's back together, we're going to have more stories focused on getting this super powerful object?
I think you're giving them a lot of credit, or I wouldn't necessarily do.
I'm sorry, Jonathan. I don't think so. I never thought I'd be agreeing with Nathan P. Butler so much on Ewoks. But Nathan's got a point. I think what they're trying to do is set up the Sunstar to be what we will later find out is a pretty powerful weapon. It's not just something that can defend the Ewoks, you know. And I think what they're doing is building it up to make it out something that in the wrong hands can be devastating. And so they're sending all of these villains to try to steal the Sunstar. And I think as an audience, we're made to believe that, oh, okay, this person wants it and this person wants it. And I think it's meant to build up. So I think we should give them credit. I think this has to be on purpose, right?
Let's talk about the Sunstar Shadowstone for a minute. Being that it's the magical stone for the Ewoks, and we've kind of discussed over and over how the Ewoks' magic, it seems to be a manifestation of the Force. I kind of taking this Sunstar Shadowstone as kind of the Kyber Crystal from Splinter of the Mind's Eye, or the ideal that was the Kyber Crystal, that this was something that can channel the Force. So you would think that who would be attracted to it would be other Force users, right?
Well, yes, except that I think we're kind of post, you know, is retconning the right word? We're kind of retconning the concept that this is Jedi related and Force sensitive, and, you know, that's what's really going on. Anything magical in the Star Wars universes is Force related. But, you know, my question even goes deeper. What does the Sunstar Shadowstone do? Why does it exist? Why do they keep it? What do they use it for? If it's so powerful and so many people are coming at it, and if it gets in the wrong hands, the universe is doomed. Why not destroy it? Why do they have it? What does it do for them? Does it run their air conditioners in the heat of the summer? Does it keep the trees of life going? Why?
And why do they keep it in essentially a cigar box on low gray shelf?
Unguarded, yes.
Unguarded in the oldest Ewok, who's getting definitely senile because he's losing himself in the middle of a blizzard. Well, that's a good question, Jerry. What does it do? What is it for? You know, up to this point, I think I've just accepted the notion that it's for Ewok defense. But I've never asked myself that question.
Well, it seems like if we go back to Sunstar versus Shadowstone, it has, at least the two separate halves, have the ability to increase magical power. When they're together, it's even more powerful. It allowed Morag to do more powerful spells. When turned against her, it was more powerful. It has the ability to open portals between this world and the spirit world, as we saw back in Night of the Stranger, and apparently it has the ability to influence the seasons, possibly, as we saw back with the Season Scepter. So we've got this super powerful object, and I'm not sure that we have to, even if we do assume that this is all Force-based, that in a sense in Star Wars is a manifestation of the Force in some other way. That doesn't necessarily mean that only Force users would want it, need it, or be able to use it. If it in and of itself can focus the Force, then, or magic, then you wouldn't necessarily have to be. But even then, doesn't have to be the case, because take a look at Tarak from Ewoks The Battle for Endor, to keep this within the Ewoks family. What does he want?
He wants the power!
And what is the power? The power is the power core, or like a power unit, needed for the star drive of a ship. He doesn't know what it is. He just knows he wants it because it's the power, and he wants Charles to be able to make it work. He just gives it to her and says, you know, make it work. And she's just sitting there looking at this piece of technology. Just because you want something because you hear it's powerful doesn't mean you have the ability to use it, nor does it mean you have the ability to even understand it. You just want power, which seems like what a lot of these bumblers that go after it want.
I think we'll have opportunity to discuss this, as certainly the concept of, hey, let's go steal the Sun Star is a theme that we'll visit quite a bit in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, back to this episode, again, this is a Chipmunks type episode of, you know, ignoring the old for the new, the cool friend at school, ignoring your brothers or whatever. I will say this, though, the little creature that this magical pony unicorn turned into was so freaking creepy.
Jerry. Oh my goodness. That thing, you know what it reminded me of? It looked like the lizard baby from the
from
V miniseries. I was like, there's no way that's a coincidence. I mean, it had the teeth and the big green forehead and the nose and the grill showing the teeth. That thing was scary. That thing was creepy.
So, speaking of an individual who's trying to steal the Sun Star Shadowstone, what do we think of Jadru as a villain?
She was absolutely perfect. I like that she had a herald. I like that this Silky was actually a herald for her to actually go out and find creatures to bring back for her to... What was she going to do with these creatures? Was she going to eat them? Take their souls? What was... I mean, she was trying to find the Sun Star, but I didn't get the feeling... I got the feeling that she did this a lot, not just for finding the Sun Star. I got the feeling she did this a lot.
Well, thank you guys for discussing these three episodes with me. As always, very good discussions and different points of view. For next time, we're going to be discussing four separate episodes: Horville's Hut of Horrors, The Tragic Flute, Just My Luck, and Bringing Up Norky. And I'm sure we're going to have a lot to say about those. But until next time, yub yub.
Dengar!
See you guys next week.
Yub yub, Commander.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Jerry, Jonathan, Nathan, and Barrett. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademark Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2013, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
The Ewoks are contacted. God damn it!
That's one.
I was fine, man. You just damn it. All right. The Ewoks are. Are you guys done?
We aren't even doing anything. We're muted, man.
I hear noises.
I didn't do anything, and I heard Barrett. I'm like, what? What did I do?
All right. Choo-choo. On a giant flying. melt.
That's two.
Wicket, Nissa, Tebow, and Latara come upon a quarf. A quarf? Am I reading that right?
Yeah, let me pull it up. They come upon a... What's the name of this? This is Vaga's rival.
Yeah.
They come upon a quarf. Yeah, that's what Silky is supposed to be, is a quarf. Let me make sure... But I'm almost positive that I've spelled that correctly. Yeah, Q-U-A-R-F, a quarf.
All right, I'm going to start over. Is that... Yeah, whatever.
Not a queef.
I wasn't even going there, thanks. Thanks just for putting that in my head.
Just saying.